All right, so are we ready to get started again after having some good food? Thank you to those of you who organized the food and who will do the cleanup. Thank you, I appreciate that. So this session is going to get a little bit more into the how. So we've kind of described the why and the places that we have some potential areas of strength and weakness and areas where we could grow in this direction. So then it gets down to the how. So how do we go about starting to put this into practice? So I'm going to share about joining in on the Eco-Reformation through something called Watershed Discipleship, which I have showed you that the book by that title, which gives way more information on it, of course. Keith mentioned in my bio that I run the blog and website that's based around the Watershed Discipleship community. So if you want to learn more, you can go online and check that out and find out more about what that means. But I'll just kind of give a general overview of what that means, because I think it's a helpful way of engaging with environmental care from a Christian framework in a way that leads to action. So one of my main concerns is that we talk about environmental care, but we don't actually do anything a lot of times, especially within the academy, which I will take full responsibility for as somebody who teaches and talks about this stuff a lot, but then getting it out into the real world where we actually do this stuff takes a little bit different type of work, and it's not always the work that the people that are writing do, but then I think in this case, it needs to be something that is a holistic process, that it's not just people up here in the ivory tower talking and writing about this stuff and expecting the people down there somewhere to put it into practice somehow, but they're not going to put the pieces together for them. I think that just continues the model of kind of this cycle of domination and control of these elite people defining this and expecting somebody else to carry it out. So so in this case, I'm hopeful that we can start bridging the gap between the academy, the theological education system particularly, and the people in the pews, the people who are implementing this stuff at the local level, and have that be a more seamless process. So I'm hopeful that watershed discipleship is a way that that is being defined that can connect those two worlds of doing really good theological work in connection with the Christian tradition, as well as focusing on how to put the stuff into action and what that looks like. So anyway, that's why I chose to talk about watershed discipleship in particular. So how do we start working in this direction? So I think first we talked in the last session about the need for humility and for repentance and turning around. So it's kind of like entering the 12-step process for addictions, of admitting we have a problem. Maybe we're a little bit addicted to fossil fuels, maybe some of us, and to the kind of comforts that we have. So admitting that we have a problem individually and culturally, and then being willing to do something about that, being in a place where we're ready to take the next step. Admitting there's a higher power being one of those steps, and in the 12-step program, which is great, that we can incorporate that piece of it is the higher power that sustains us through the process of learning how to turn around and go a different direction. So so I see a lot of connections actually between the way that we deal with addictions and the way that we need to deal with environmental concerns in our own lives, for those of us who are using more resources than we really need. So it's a painful process, and it's not something that I think that we can do until we're ready. Just like with an addiction, it's not something that we can shame somebody into. So, if you have somebody in your life who's an alcoholic or has some other addiction, you can't shame them into getting treatment, right? They have to be ready to do it. It has to be something that comes from inside of themselves. And so that's very similar to the type of work that we're doing with environmental concerns is recognizing those places in ourselves that we need to work on. And when we're ready, we can take those steps. But it helps to have a community around us, right? When you're doing the 12-step program, you have a community of people that you work with and that you journey with, and you have moments where you know that you've messed up and you have somebody to talk to about that. And you have moments where you can celebrate the fact that you've done a good job and made it through the day or the week, and celebrate that with a group of people. So having that community around us as we deal with this addiction to overuse of resources is important. So anyway, if that's a helpful model, you can hold that in your mind and think about the places of resistance in yourself as we go through this this next section. So I'm going to kind of give an overview of some of the reasons why we are in this place of being kind of addicted to overuse of resources, and then discuss watershed discipleship as a possible way to move forward from a Christian framework, and then give us some time to reflect together on steps that we might take individually and as meetings and as the friends in the Bay Area to start addressing environmental care in this community, hopefully. So that's kind of where we're going with the rest of our time together. So the main reason that we've been talking about that that we have this problem at this point is the way that we have structured our society, where in order to get ahead, you have to knock somebody else down, right? You have to beat out somebody else. So it's very based on competition. And in that case, we have to be afraid of each other. We have to always be afraid that somebody else is going to come in and take our role, and then we will be disposable, we will be unnecessary, or we will be knocked down the ladder. So if we don't have that spot, then somebody else will replace us, and we will have to go down farther on the ladder. We have to be afraid that we won't ever have enough, so we always have to be acquiring more and more in case there's a time when we don't have enough, and then we'll have some reserve, right? We have to convince other people that we are worthy by consuming more so that they can see that we have enough and we're not to be bothered, so that we give the perception of power and control. So we've structured our society to have to fear one another, to have to always be anxious, to have to always keep working in order to show that we're not replaceable, that we are still valuable within the system. We base our value as a culture on how much we can produce and whether or not we're useful in the system of production, and whether or not we're useful consumers as well. So we have a problem of that sense of unlimited production, right? We have an unlimited growth trajectory that we're trying to be on. But our planet has limits, and our physical selves have limits. Our community has limits of what we can handle together. And so finding those limits is an important part of what it means to be a person of faith. And that's why we have emphasis on rest and Sabbath in the Hebrew tradition particularly, but Jesus spent times of rest and Sabbath as well, and going out and taking space when he needed it, and taking time to just be with God and be with his friends and not friends, be with other people. And that he modeled that sense of having space and of valuing people for themselves rather than what they could do or what they could produce. So part of our problem, I think, as a culture is the way that we value or don't value people. And I think that's not what our Christian tradition tells us. Our Christian tradition tells us that we're valuable as human beings, as beloved children of God, and as part of this good creation. But our culture tells us that we're only valuable if we can do something for the culture, if we can produce something. And once we can no longer produce anything, we're not of value to the culture. And so we internalize that a lot of times, and we are fearful and anxious. So I invite you to just take a moment to close your eyes and be still. And imagine and pay attention to what rises in you when you think about having enough. How do you know when you have enough? So just spend a moment sitting with that. How do you know when you have enough? And now take a moment to reflect on when was the last time that you gave yourself rest? Not just going to sleep at night, but rest at another time. Maybe for some of you, you have a rhythm of taking days of rest or times of rest throughout your day. Maybe for some of you that's less common. So think about how you feel about giving yourself a day to rest every week. What would that feel like? What does that bring up in you? And for a moment, let's just practice rest. So release all of that, let go of that, and just allow yourself to rest for a moment here in this time, in this place, and be present. You can go ahead and open your eyes. So I don't know about you, but at least for me, sometimes when I think about, well, if I took a full day off from doing anything, it feels like I wouldn't have time. I wouldn't be able to get everything done that I want to do. I wouldn't be able to do all these good things that I'm doing. I would have to be afraid that I couldn't support my children. I couldn't keep a clean enough house. I wouldn't have enough time to do all the things, fun things with my family that I want to and that I feel like it takes to be an American family right now. So there's a lot that comes up when we think about giving ourselves permission to rest. I don't think that I'm alone in that. Maybe the rest of you have mastered that, but for many people in our society, we don't give ourselves permission to rest. And why is that? I wonder if we feel like we don't deserve it, or we're not valuable if we can't produce something during that time. We're not meeting expectations for our roles or what we expect of ourselves because of what society tells us we're supposed to be like. And there are genuine fears of literally not being able to put food on the table for many of us who don't have a high-paying job, right? So some of these are manufactured anxieties by our own minds, and some of them are real, like you can't rest because you have to work all the time in order to feed your family. So these are real concerns of our society, of needing to always be doing something. And that's what is causing this environmental situation, right? We always need more and more and more. And for a lot of people, whenever you ask them what is enough, the answer is, well, just a little bit more than what I have, right? So does that sound familiar to any of you? Like, well, if I just had the next step up of whatever it is that I'm going for next. And I fall into that trap often too. So as long as we continue to do that, though, we're always going to be trying to get more and more. And that's not to say that we shouldn't always be trying to make things work better and more efficient and be able to figure things out and create something that will work even better than what is already happening. Because those are fun and creative problem-solving things to do. But to have that be what drives us, and that we can't stop, we can't rest, we can't take a break, we can't find value just in who we are in as children of God, I think that's when it becomes too much and unhealthy for us. And we have this fear and anxiety that if we don't keep doing that, then somebody else is going to make it impossible for us to get enough. So people are calling this tendency affluenza. So we're going to take a little quiz here. So what do you think? Which of the following is comparable in size to today's typical three-car garage? A basketball court, a McDonald's restaurant, an RV, or the average home in the 1950s? Any guesses?
D.
Yeah, D. So the average family lived in what is now a three-car garage. Since the 1950s, Americans have used more resources than everyone who ever lived before them, the combined third world populations, the Romans at the height of the Roman Empire, or all of the above. What do you think? All of the above in the last 65 years. I think this was from 2015, so. Yeah, so that kind of puts it into perspective, huh? That if every day we say, well, if I just had a little bit more, then I would be happy, then I would be satiated. And then we lose all proportion of what happened before and what people were able to live with before us. And things become normal that weren't normal before, but to the extent that we are using 1.5 times the Earth's resources as a global population. So affluenza is described as a painful, contagious, socially transmitted condition of overload, debt, anxiety, and waste, resulting from the dogged pursuit of more. Our technologically advanced society has achieved wonders our ancestors could never have envisioned. We've put people on the moon, decoded DNA, and cured diseases. The problem is, this collective level of power is also destroying our world. Countless seemingly innocent activities and choices are acting together to bring about the sixth mass extinction in our planet's history. So we've done great things, and it's amazing what we can do now, right? And there's the other side of it. And here we get into the structural piece, the structural sin piece. That sin in its fullest sense refers to disorientation from right relationship with God, which then leads to disorientation from right relationship with self, others, and all of creation. So it's not something that we're doing by ourselves, and it's not something that we can fix by ourselves, right? But it's this structure that we're held in where we're disoriented from right relationship. So one of the most telling stories about affluenza is this teenager named Ethan Couch. I don't know if you heard about him, but he stole some alcohol. He was driving drunk, and he struck and killed four people. One passenger in his car was paralyzed, and others were injured. Then he fled the scene. And, of course, he's white. And his lawyer claimed affluenza as his defense because he was never taught to connect his actions with their consequences. So the lawyer claimed it wasn't this kid's fault because he hadn't been taught to connect actions with consequences. So he hadn't ever been taught that if you drive drunk and hit somebody, then you're responsible for that. So he was sentenced to an upscale teen substance abuse and mental health rehab facility that his parents paid for. And then he eventually also had to serve 2 years in prison because he didn't meet with his probation officer regularly. And so, but otherwise he wouldn't have had to serve jail time because they basically let him off on this defense because he hadn't been taught any better. So this is kind of the definition of affluenza, of not connecting our actions with our consequences. So unfortunately, we do this all the time, right? We eat food that we have no idea where it came from and where the packaging from it came from, where the packaging is going to go after we throw it away, what the treatment of the people was like in the factories that produce the packaging and in the farms that produce the food or the factories that process the food. We have no idea what the supply chain was. We have no idea what chemicals were used on those plants and in those factories. So we're not connecting our actions with their consequences. So we all suffer from this to some degree, unfortunately, probably, if we live here. And it's kind of inescapable because if we thought about all of those things all the time, we wouldn't be able to do anything, right? We'd be kind of paralyzed. So this is where it gets into thinking about getting over that moral oblivion. So when we think about structural sin and we see ourselves enmeshed in that, the first step is recognizing the structures that are holding us there and seeing them and being aware of them. So we're kind of taking that first step today, or possibly you've taken that step already, and that's why you're here, because you're interested in this topic, of just becoming aware of the environmental problems that are out there and how they're related to our actions and how they're causing injustice for people today and people in the future. This structure is pretty invisible to those who benefit from it. And so that means that for those of us who are privileged people, we have to listen to people that are oppressed by these systems and be really willing to listen to those voices. Otherwise, we can't see it very well. And this happens no matter whether the individual people involved in the system are personally virtuous or not. And that's the hard part about it, because each of us is trying so hard to be virtuous people, right? We're trying so hard to be the people of God and the people that God wants us to be, and yet we're stuck in this structure. And so so it's really important to not let this get you down and make you feel like, oh, what am I? I'm such an evil person. But we're caught in this whether or not we're trying to be virtuous. And it's transmitted from generation to generation. we transmit it to our kids. We give them the expectation that they'll have a similar lifestyle, right? And then it's expanded by concentration of power. So we see this happening with globalization, where the Western model of expansion has now reached most of the way around the globe, right? And impacted most countries in the world because of the concentration of power in that hierarchy that we talked about, and the willingness of many of us to go along with it because it benefits us to some degree. And so there's this privilege paradox where you can't dismantle structural sin just by doing individual actions, right? My individual actions aren't going to dismantle this system. But it can't be dismantled without our individual actions, right? So we still need to act even though our actions aren't going to make the difference. So we need collective action and a collective moral agency to combat the moral oblivion that we've been talking about. So we collectively try to be oblivious as a culture and ignore the whole supply chain and the justice issues and all those things. And so to combat that, we need collective moral agency. So my choices can't fix the problem, but I still need to act. That's part of my responsibility as a human being who's part of a community. And that begins with remembering. So I talked about the concept of remembering, bringing the members back together. So we're part of one body. So when we think of the church as the body of Christ, remembering ourselves and being an actual body that that supports one another and that does the work of a body together, that's important. And then also extending that out into the whole of creation, where as a body of Christ, we're part of this broader ecosystem, and we need the other parts of the ecosystem in order for ourselves to survive. Otherwise, it's going to be really hard to breathe or drink water or have food to eat, right? So I wanted to, watershed discipleship is kind of the opposite side of it is watershed conquest. So I'm going to deal with that first and then get into watershed discipleship. So watershed conquest is this idea that, or this reality, that back in the 15th century, the popes created these papal bulls, these kind of written documents that said that discovered lands and territories, resources, and people could be claimed for the state if they weren't yet Christians. And so when Europeans discovered, I definitely put that in quotes since there were people here already, a new place, they could claim it for the church and for their state because those people weren't Christian yet. So they needed to bring Christianity to them. And so when they discovered the mouth of a river, then they could claim that entire watershed based on the principle of contiguity. So all of the land that was contiguous to that water source was claimed for the name of that state and for the church due to the doctrine of discovery. And so this led to, obviously, colonizing places in the name of the church with the goal of evangelism. And so it was based on the Great Commission because go and make disciples of all nations, right? And so if we take the good news to them, then that sanctifies anything else that might happen in that space. So this is the idea of watershed conquest, and that is how, you know, all the Americas were claimed, and other, you know, Africa and other areas of the world were claimed based on this in order to spread Christianity. But at the same time, going in there and taking the natural resources from the people who already lived there and shipping them back to Europe. So this is based on a few things that are kind of theological, but this idea of functional docetism. So the docetism is the idea that Jesus only seemed to have a physical body, but he was really just a spirit. And so if you think that Jesus was just a spirit, then he wasn't connected to the material world, and therefore you can continue thinking that the material world is evil and only the spirit is good. So that was a heresy that was tamped down by the church early on, but it continues to live on in the ways that we function. So this idea that you can separate souls from bodies, not literally, but you can separate the fact that, hey, we're going in there and saving native people's souls, even though we're enslaving their bodies. So being willing to sacrifice the justice and the humanity of people in order to save their souls. It also requires placing humanity above creation hierarchically as closer to God, and believing that creation is only here for us. So when we have that belief, we have a tendency to think that all of this is here for us to use no matter what impact it has on the other species or the land and water. And so we think this fairly frequently, right? That humanity is kind of at the pinnacle of creation and we're better than everybody else, and therefore all of the rest of it is here for us. Whereas the Bible doesn't really say that. The Bible says we're here to take care of the rest of it, right? We're here to learn how to care for it and become skilled masters at caring for the creation. And so by placing ourselves at the top of that hierarchy closest to God, we often think that we have a divine right to all of the resources. But that's not what the biblical tradition tells us. And it doesn't work out very well for the health of the land and the people on it in the long run. So, yeah, and then that last bullet point there is, again, this idea that we have this divine grant from God to go and claim the other lands in order to spread the gospel. So this idea that, you know, we talked about it in American history later on as manifest destiny, that we have been chosen, we're the chosen people by God to spread the good news in the new world, and therefore, no matter what we do, it's right because we have this destiny from God. And so that has led to, you know, taking the land from the native people, enslaving people, and taking all of the natural resources that we can and moving on to the next place that has natural resources. And this is all based in the church and this idea that we need to go there and save souls, and so we can justify our other actions by the fact that we're evangelizing. So this is a pretty sad heritage for those of us who are European Americans, and it's hard to know what to do about it because we live here now, right? So how do we repent? How do we turn around from that? So I'm hopeful that Watershed Discipleship offers a way to begin that turning around process. So this concept is based on the idea that, first of all, we're in this watershed moment of ecological crisis where we've degraded the planet pretty well. We've put a lot of poisons in the water and the air and the land. We're causing a lot of climate change, and we're in this moment where we can hopefully still recover from some of it, but it's kind of a tipping point moment, right? And so it invites us to be disciples in our watersheds and disciples of our watersheds. So paying attention to what is going on within our watershed. I'll just define watershed in just a second. But it provides kind of a bounded space for us to think about the amount of space that we have to be in charge of. Because if you think of like trying to save the entire planet, that's a little big for our minds to handle, and it's not really our job, right? We get into trouble when we try to be the savior. But we can care about a small place around us. So disciples in our watersheds, learning how to re-inhabit them. So when Christianity became a religion for everybody and it was universal, that meant it wasn't connected to a place anymore. So within Judaism, they're really connected to that piece of land and that place, and if they didn't care for it, their ancestors wouldn't have that place. But Christianity has been too easily turned to imperial ends because we're trying to go always to the frontier, always to someplace new to bring the gospel to somebody new, and in the process also using up the resources there, because then we can just go to another place because no particular place is sacred. We can just go someplace else if we run out of room here. So instead of that being replaced into our places, focusing again on really caring for the places in which we live and the communities of people and the communities of other creatures that live in this place with us. So disciples in our watersheds and disciples of our watersheds. So one of the people kind of defining this movement is Todd Winward, and he talks about watershed as rabbi. And so we learn as from a teacher, a wise teacher, things about God from paying attention to the natural world around us. So maybe we learn about God's immensity by looking at the stars. Maybe we learn something about how God cares for even the smallest creatures by paying attention to, you know, a little tiny bug. So the watershed around us can speak to us about who God is and who we are in relationship to God and creation. So within, I mean, within the Bible, you even have the other creatures teaching us things. I think of Balaam and his donkey, or Jesus using the parables as, you know, he tells a lot of parables about, look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field, and learning things about God and about our place in the world through looking at the natural world. So being disciples of our watersheds, being willing to pay attention to the wisdom that we can learn from the world around us. So those are the three main points of recognizing that we have a problem, right? seeing the ecological crisis for what it is, getting rid of that kind of cultural amnesia and being willing to be aware. And then being disciples in our watersheds, really placed here, being willing to be rooted and grounded in the place in which we are, and being disciples of our watersheds and being willing to learn to learn from the wisdom of the natural world around us. Those are the three main ideas. So what is a watershed, you might be asking? So it's that area of land, a bounded hydrologic system, a bounded water system, within which all living things are inextricably linked by their common water course, and where, as humans settled, simple logic demanded that they became part of the community. So you can see a watershed here in this image, where we're on one side of this hill. The water flows down this direction, and on the other side it flows down this direction. So there's one watershed in here, and there would be a different one over here where the water flows down that hill. So it's a way of kind of looking at the space in which we reside and being able to break it into natural units rather than grids, which kind of are arbitrary and don't have much to do with the world around us. So, you know, within a different watershed, there might be a little bit different ecosystem, right? Based on where the water is and where the sun is and the different wind patterns and all those things. So a watershed is kind of its own unit of care and needs to be cared for in a particular way. It's also pretty scalable, so you can have like a watershed, a really tiny watershed based around whatever the smallest creek is that flows by your house. And then up into like the biggest river in your region. So in my region, there's a little creek called Hess Creek that runs pretty close to my house. So I would be in that little Hess Creek watershed, but then it flows into the Willamette River. So that's a pretty big watershed in the Willamette Valley. And then to the Columbia River, which goes all the way up into Canada. And so that's a even bigger kind of bioregion level watershed. And then, of course, that flows into the ocean. So in a sense, we're all part of the same watershed, but it's scalable that way. So you can think of, on different scales, you know, I'm caring for this one little part that's around my home, but then it impacts the whole rest of the world because we're all connected through the water flowing through all of our regions. So I think it's a helpful way to kind of break down what is the unit of care that we're talking about here, because talking about environmental care of the whole planet is too hard and too big and too much to bite off, right? We can't do that. But we can find out what the needs are in our little tiny community. Who else lives in this area? And how can we start contributing to caring for them, right? So here, I think you're in the San Francisco Bay Delta watershed. I think that's what it's called. Yes, I wrote it down. So, you know, thinking about that watershed as your unit of care, you can think about what would be those first steps that you would do within this watershed to care for this region and the people and other creatures within it. And then that impacts, of course, other regions, because as you care for this place, it has a positive impact on the rest of the world, too. If you clean up your air, it moves around, right? If you clean up your water, it moves around. And if you're only using things that you produce here in this region, for example, then you're only then you're not taking from another watershed and using its resources here. So I think that's a helpful way to kind of make this something that we can fit our minds around, hopefully. So here's the watershed map of the United States. I think it's really pretty. If you're in the Mississippi River watershed, you might want to choose one of the smaller rivers to focus on. So the only problem with this idea is that if we focus on our own watershed, we can sometimes get kind of parochial and only do good things for our own area and not for other people. So we're trying to avoid NIMBYism, which NIMBY stands for not in my backyard. So it's a concern that a lot of people raise about environmentalists, is that they only, you know, they say we're not going to have a, coal plant in our backyard, in our region, but you can put it over there somewhere else. We'll still use the power from it, but we don't want it to be near us because we don't want to have to breathe that stuff. But it has to be somewhere, right? So we don't want it to be where we just make somebody else have to deal with the pollution while we get to have clean air. So we're trying to avoid that. But I think Watershed Discipleship tries to avoid NIMBYism by paying attention to the way that our care of our watershed impacts other people. So I love the quote by Wendell Berry, "Do unto others downstream what you would have those upstream do unto you." Yeah, so a kind of restating of the golden rule that as we do in our watershed for those who are downstream of us, it's going to come back around, right? It's going to impact the way that the other people, not only downstream, but ourselves, are treated if the whole system works that way. And tending to our place tends the world. So obviously, if everyone takes care of their place, then the whole world gets taken care of. But if we are only tending to our place and then bringing in a bunch of stuff from somewhere else where they're not able to tend to their place because we're using all of their resources, that's not really tending our place. That's, being a suction on the system, right? Sucking in more resources than that region can support and can allow. So we're trying to tend to our place by utilizing the resources that are available there and making sure that they'll continue on into the future. So this final one, we won't save places we don't love, we can't love places we don't know, and we don't know places we haven't learned. So this requires us getting to know our watersheds, right? So knowing not only the name of our watershed, but the geographical space in which it is, and what are the species that live here, and getting to love that region. So maybe you already do, probably. Maybe go outside in different places and get to know what it's like at different seasons, connect with the different species that are here, and learn to love them, find out what they do for the system, the ecosystem, and get to love this place. Even the built spaces, right? We've got the built environment and the natural environment and the social environment. So social environment is like people, society, natural environment, obviously, the natural world, and the built environment being cities and other infrastructure that humans create. So even the built environment is part of that system, right? So even getting to know and love that infrastructure that we build on this place as part of the ecosystem and figuring out how and whether it fits in with the rest of the ecosystem and the way that the watershed is supposed to be functioning. So getting to know the places where we live and learning to love them, learning what they need and how to care for them, just like in any other relationship, right? If you know what your spouse needs at a certain time of day, maybe you will treat them differently if they're a morning person or they're a night person, or if you know when they get home from work they need a little bit of space, or whatever it is that you know about your spouse, you will hopefully try to care for them in that way that they need because you love that person. So doing that same sort of care for the places in which we live, knowing what they need at different times, knowing the things that they need as inputs and outputs in order for them to function healthily, and participating in that process as in a relationship of care. So I think watershed discipleship helps us to kind of aim towards that center there of sustainability or shalom. So it focuses on kind of trying to create a local economy so that the people who live in a region are able to be supported by that region. So if we grow the things that we need in our region and we can eat all those things here and then use the compost to go back into growing more things, I think San Francisco is doing a pretty good job of trying to do that. So yay. And so continuing to make that system work even better and flourish and have it not just be food but all the other products that we use. So I'm hoping that this can be palatable across the political spectrum. So we were talking about this a little bit at lunch, that, you know, is this a red and a blue sort of a thing where only the people in the blue states are going to get on board with this? So how do we make this be something that goes across the political aisle? And I'm hopeful that this can be something that has that potential because, first of all, I think mostly we generally tend to associate environmental concerns with the blue side of things, right? So we've got liberal people saying we should care for the planet, but conservative people are about conserving. So I think conservation should be something that is natural in conservative political spectrum, as well as, you know, focusing on local economies. I mean, that's what the conservative platform has been in the past. So focusing on that sense of regional control of resources and building up a community in the place where you are rather than having a lobby forced on you from over in Washington or whatever. So if we can kind of come together across the political spectrum and try to focus on these things that are going to be good for the community and they aren't partisan and draw from both political persuasions, I'm hopeful that we could make some progress at some point, maybe when we're not so divisive politically. So I think this is also doable because, like I said, if we have this huge, like we have to save the world thing, that's not doable. But when we have a sense of caring for our watershed and working together with the people around us who live in this region to do this work, that feels more doable than trying to get some international law passed, right? So not that international laws shouldn't be passed, but we can start with our local level and work up from there. And I do think that this sort of a thing, it needs to be part of the future of the church. There needs to be something that we stand for and that we that the Christianity is actually good news. So I think that this has the potential of being a way for us to move forward to show a shalom community in action, that we are not only talking about this liberal agenda, but we are putting things into practice in a way that benefits the whole community and that brings people together across political divides and that makes the place more livable for all the people and all the creatures. I think that as friends right now, we're having a hard time standing for something in a positive way. So I think we stand for a lot of things. But I think we need to really intentionally listen to the Spirit on how to move forward at this time in our history, and that this is a piece of it, this expansion of the Reformation beyond just people into recognizing that we're part of the broader community of creation, and that we're participants in this creation story, this creation narrative that includes all of us as living beings. And so I think this is the work of our time, and this is something that as people of faith right now, it's going to take a lot of work, because for those of us who have grown up here in the United States and are fairly privileged, this is hard work to extricate ourselves from affluenza, to overcome the desire that we have for moral oblivion, to just ignore all that stuff and do the good things that we can do, but to really take a good hard look at that internally, not pointing fingers at other people, but, you know, doing the work ourselves and as a community. So I think this has potential to be our work as a church community. And wanted to give us freedom to feel the despair and the pain that comes with these realizations. So I'm going to be talking more about hope tomorrow, but despair is actually a sign of hope, if you can believe it, because it means that you haven't given up, that you have a vision for a better future and another way, and you have a vision for the kingdom of God, that shalom community. You just don't quite see how to get there yet, right? So when we recognize ourselves feeling despair, that's an important time to remind ourselves of the hope that we have. So we have the hope that we can trust that the God who has brought us through all these other things throughout Jewish and Christian history and throughout Quaker history will continue to guide us and is leading us and working in us to create that community. So as we recognize that despair, it can remind us of the hope that we have. And this is a painful process. And in Western culture, we like to do everything that we can to avoid pain. And so allowing ourselves to feel that pain is an important part of this process. Not avoiding it, not ignoring it, not trying to cover it up and medicate it, but really feeling it. And that's hard work, and it's not comfortable, and it's not something that can be done in a day. But despair and pain are normal responses to this. So what can we do? In the church, we have some ways to deal with these feelings of despair and pain. We don't always do them well, but I think that we can use lament, feeling really sad about this situation, and crying out to God about it. Confession, confessing our own part and our own obligation and responsibility. Repentance, turning around, and atonement, becoming one with God and being reconciled with one another. We can use these things that are part of Christian tradition and part of many faith traditions to help us move out of this place of despair and pain and to deal with those things as a community. So as we provide spaces for ourselves to lament, spaces for ourselves to confess and to turn around, spaces for ourselves to do the positive reconciling work, that's how we move through the despair and the pain together. And those are things that the church can offer that the rest of our culture doesn't do well. I've been studying hope quite a bit because I need it when studying this field. And what I've noticed that is included in hope is that in order to hope, you have to see reality as it is. So you have to be willing to face into what's actually there. So if you hope for something
that isn't in line with reality, it's never going to happen, right? It's just optimism or wishful thinking. So for it to be real hope, you have to actually see the situation as it is and hope for a certain outcome. In this case, regarding climate change and environmental concerns, you have to be willing to grieve and commit to turning around. So in order to hope, we have to, I mean, it's going to make us feel sad when we see reality as it is, because it's a sad situation. So grieving and going through that process is really important. And then committing to turn around, because otherwise there's not much hope of going a better direction, right? And then imagine. So imagine what a better future would look like, or a different, a sustainable way of living together as a community. And have that space of imagining together. And then make a plan. And then do it. Take a step in that direction. And another step. With people. So that's important. I mean, if you don't have other people to do it with, you can do it on your own. And connect with other people online, which is helpful that we have that global community that way, but it's better for our mental health generally if we can work with other people who are nearby us. So take a step with other people and another step, and keep taking steps, even if they're really small ones. And then celebrate. Yay, we did something and it worked. Or yay, we did something and it failed spectacularly and we're going to try again. So celebrate even the small things. So like at my meeting, we have coffee on Sunday mornings, and so I don't know, it's been like 4 years that I've been talking about, like, maybe we should get like ceramic mugs and just wash them instead of paper cups and plastic lids, and, you know, little creamers and little plastic containers. And so finally we got a little cream pitcher, so we don't have little plastic cream things that we throw away for every single person's coffee cup. So we still have paper cups and plastic lids, but we finally got a refillable creamer thing. Yay! So so the pastoral team and I really celebrated, yay, we did this thing, when we got that, even though it's like this tiny step, but it's like, we did something about this. We've been talking about it for 4 years, and we finally did one thing. So, yeah, it's crazy how much comes up. So in this situation, I talked about switching out the cups, and they're like, well, maybe we should change the whole entrance to the meeting house, because if we change the cups, then we have to have a place to put them, and then we have to have a place to wash them, and where will people come in, and then they'll leave them all in the entryway. And so it became like this huge conversation of, we're going to have to change the way that we come into the building if we change the paper cups. So these things happen, and even though my congregation that I go to really cares about this topic, it's still taken us this long and we haven't changed out the paper cups, but we're working on it. So we celebrated the creamer thing, and we're still working. So so celebration is an important piece. Giving ourselves grace about the process is important. Practicing trust and gratitude. So being grateful for what we have, that we do have enough, that God sustains us through all of this, that we are valuable and beloved children of God, that are valuable in this community regardless of what we produce or what we can do, that we're valuable as ourselves, that we can trust that who we are is enough. And we can trust that when we come together as a community, it will be enough. So practicing that intentionally together is an important piece of this as well. It keeps us grounded and sane, and it gives us spiritual centeredness for the long haul. So this isn't something that happens overnight. It's a long-term vision. And so we need to have these spiritual practices that keep us grounded in trusting and being grateful. All right, so we're going to move into a section where we think about our own next steps. So I wanted to show you this spheres of influence. I'm not sure you can read that, but I'll read it for you. So you've got the person in the middle, and then You've got your private and personal sphere, so maybe your family or the people that you live in your house with. And so it suggests things like learn about environmental concerns, donate money and time, walk instead of drive, reduce, reuse, recycle. Then your social network doesn't mean just social media, it just means anybody that you're networked with socially. So it suggests share material goods, teach, persuade, support others, and be a leader. The organizational sphere, so any organizations that you're connected with and a part of, you can share ideas, change processes and procedures, create durable products. So you could try to get people to change out paper and plastic coffee cups. or you can create durable products if you're in an organization that creates goods. The public sphere, run for public office, create laws, organize, vote, protest. And the cultural sphere, change norms, systems, stories, and symbols. So the stories that we tell in church, the stories that we tell about who we are as a congregation, the stories that we tell about our personal history and our nation's history, changing those stories to recognize the misuse of land and resources and people can be really powerful and impactful in all of this. Okay, so those are the different spheres of influences. So you've got the private and personal, social network, organizational, public, and cultural. And let's see. So there, most of them are listed on this one. So I'm going to encourage you to take like 5 minutes. Yeah, let's take 5 minutes to kind of sit with this yourself and make a plan about things that you think you could do at those various levels that you might feel called to do, or that you just have an idea that maybe you could do. So first, it's kind of a brainstorm session with yourself. You can write things down or just think about it. What are some things that you could do at these various levels? A step you could take, a small step. So I'll give you 5 minutes to kind of think about that and come up with as many ideas as you want to, and then I'll have you talk about it with other people, but start with thinking about it yourself. All right, so I realized there was one important part of this that I was going to have you do before you did that, but that's okay, which is shout out some of the things that you're doing on each of these levels already, because one of the important things is being aware of what you've done already and that celebrating the fact that you're already taking steps. And so you've got a place to start from. So so we'll go back to the slide before this. And so what are some of the things, just shout them out, things on the private and personal level within your household that you do that are environmentally friendly?
Bicycle.
Public transit.
I installed a solar panel.
A solar panel on your house?
Eating grass-fed beef.
Grass-fed beef?
Mm-hmm. Recycling.
No beef. Recycling?
Yeah. Composting.
Aiming to shop.
Composting. What was that?
Aiming to shop locally as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And organic when it's affordable.
Yeah. Purchase local and organic products when they're available and affordable. Yeah, back here.
No meat and no dairy.
No meat and no dairy. Yeah, so the meat thing is definitely an environmental issue in the sense of how much fossil fuels it takes to produce the meat and the land that and the greenhouse gases that the cows emit particularly, and all of the waste that runs off into the rivers and all those things. So while eating meat in general might not be unethical, it is definitely an environmental impact. So that's great. All right, so what about the social network? What do you do within your social spheres of influence?
Carpool to meeting.
Carpool to meeting, yeah.
Post good news on the internet.
Yeah, post good news on the internet. Yeah, not just the bad news. Good idea.
It's a good money to organizations that I would like to recommend.
Mm-hmm. Contributing money to organizations with good causes. Yeah.
Something fun I did with my daughter, we read the book, Climate of Hope, and we shared.
Great. So reading a book, Climate of Hope, and then sharing with others about it.
We installed a little free library in front of our house.
Yeah.
So it's community, but also, reducing the need to buy new books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little free library to share, a kind of sharing economy, so that's great.
Going to the local, what's the next level of the kindergarten?
Grade school.
Grade school to talk about planting of trees.
Yeah, teaching grade schoolers about planting trees. All right, good stuff. How about at the level of organizations that you're a part of?
We have a food pantry here, and we get a lot of vegetables that are not in their prime, but give them to people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so food pantry and using food that would otherwise be wasted. Yeah, yeah. That's a huge problem, is all the food waste that we have in this country, that the food that's produced, but nobody ever eats it. And yeah, very sad. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm part of a class that where I'm going to be a master recycler.
Nice.
So that will eventually be an organizational goal to do outreach and writing and whatever else they have in mind.
Master Recycler program, and being able to use that in various organizations and places where you have a voice. Yeah.
Okay. I belong to several bicycle advocacy groups.
Okay. Yeah. Bicycle advocacy, so you try to make it more possible for people to bike. Yeah, thanks. Good.
I work for the Bay Area Rapid Transit in a job that absorbs most of my time and energy. Like, I consider that to be environmental activism.
Yeah, so working for Bay Area Rapid Transit so that you make it possible for the rest of us to use public transportation.
Yeah, I work at the library, so I guess that's on that line too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the library sharing economy, working together for education. What was that?
Yeah, at the local hospital as a chaplain. Mm-hmm. 4 hours. Mm-hmm.
Great. Volunteering as a chaplain at the hospital. Yeah, what about here in the meeting house? Do you do anything as a meeting here? I think you've planted drought-resistant plants. That's really good.
You noticed that, yeah. Uh-huh.
So, at Santa Cruz meeting, because the impact of climate change is going to be fewer but more intense storms and a lot of runoff, mm-hmm. So our environmental committee, which is the Friends of the Community of Nature Committee, which is the fund committee, got the meeting to spend $1,500 on drilling a core on the edge of our property to see how thick the impermeable layer was, and it's actually not as thick as we thought, so we can have a little rain collection injecting into the aquifer.
Great, wow, that's cool. Yeah, so what do you call that? It's not a rain catch system exactly, but sort of.
Well, it's the stormwater stewardship.
Okay, great. Participating in the stormwater stewardship program at the Santa Cruz meeting, you said?
Yeah, there's three churches in a row, and so it's on a downslope, so there's pink parking lot, pink parking lot, pink parking lot. We're at the bottom, but so we're hoping to work with those other churches. That part will take some time. And we're also working with the county and the city
on the SoCal Water District.
That's exciting. Thanks. Yeah, that's something that maybe other meeting houses could think about, right?
Started by the meeting curmudgeon.
I love the fun committee. That's a good idea. What is it? Friends in Unity with Nature? We should name all our committees that, right? All right. And at the public level, what do you do already? So, policy, yeah.
I wrote some short stories and published them online. Mm-hmm. Is that public?
Yes. Yeah, so writing.
I mean, the stories are about fiction. Mm-hmm. It's fiction.
Okay.
It's supposed to excite people. The new paradigm.
Yeah, so I think we often get more engaged through story, right? So it's a good way, telling stories about climate change and its impacts in such a way that might get people more interested in caring about this.
I'm mostly retired, but I do some mental health assessments for attorneys and undocumented immigrants. Mm. And I sometimes get overwhelmed with the futility of it. Mm-hmm. What I do, because there are so many of them, and some of them won't get their papers. Mm-hmm. And when I'm overwhelmed with a sense of futility, I think of one of my favorite quotes from Mahatma Gandhi. Almost anything you do will be insignificant, but it is most important that you do it.
Yeah. Yeah, almost anything that you do will be insignificant, but it's most important that you do it. Yeah. And immigration topics maybe aren't directly connected to environmental concerns, but if you think about the reasons for people wanting to immigrate here, a lot of it has to do with environmental topics. So we're using resources in other places so that people that live there can't have access to them, or we're trying to get oil in those places, which is a natural resource, and causing conflict there. So all of these things are intertwined, right? So working with immigrants to try to help them be able to live in this country safely, or live somewhere safely, is connected to the environmental concern, and all of these justice issues are connected in similar ways. So all of this justice work that we're doing in some ways is probably connected to environmental concerns. Yeah.
I heard that Buddhist nuns who became an environmental activist because she realized that climate change was creating drought, which was creating refugee crises. And so she was she realized that working on climate change was critical if you were involved with people.
Yeah. So connecting the dots between, you know, if we really care about social justice issues and we see the steps back from that of why those social justice issues are happening, usually it's connected with a natural resource or a climate change problem. So that's part of that work of becoming awake and not letting ourselves stay in that place of moral oblivion. Keith?
So supporting organizations that are involved with access to family planning technologies and also family planning awareness through the media. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so working on family planning plans. Yeah.
So I am planning on being supportive of the campaign for county supervisor of a man who has Santa Cruz County, so there's better transport, other kinds of transportation from from Santa Cruz to the Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. So that whole thing doesn't get, it's already horrible and clogged. And he also is supporting lowering the housing costs so people can live and work and don't have to commute so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes kind of mind-boggling how interconnected these things are. So supporting rapid transit or public transit initiatives in various places that don't have it yet, and then supporting affordable housing so people don't have to use so many fossil fuels to get to work and back.
Supporting organizations that work for the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so supporting environmental organizations with your money and your body, right? Okay, so what are some of the cultural ways that you're working to do environmental care. So it talks about changing norms, systems, stories, and symbols.
This has been said already, but it's cultural too. You're changing riding buses.
Riding buses, so changing the story of how we get around and what we're entitled to. Yeah. Did you have a hand up?
I read something the other day where a woman talked about admiring someone's dress, and the first young woman said, "Oh, I got it at the thrift store. Isn't it wonderful?" Changing. I mean, I have my own issues around that, but that's a different story. But just the changing the culture of what is actually acceptable. And, what you actually mean.
Yeah.
And I have no idea how to do that.
Yeah, so being proud of reusing things instead of buying new and that sort of thing, and sharing that with your anybody who asks, not probably just, you know, well, I did this thing, but obviously we have to be careful of not coming across as like holier than thou, but if it's like out of a space of joy of like, oh, isn't this great, it can be a great way to change the story. Yeah.
The driver doesn't spend 2 hours crossing the bridge, and the riders can free up space and art.
Okay, so a program called Casual Carpool. So you just catch a ride with somebody that maybe you don't know, but they're going in the same direction.
Line up in front of the bar.
Oh, great.
In order to get a carpool.
Cool.
Just get in the car, and then the car can go.
Wow, that's great. I bet it builds some sort of a sense of community, too, because you get to know people you wouldn't otherwise. Great. Okay, so I don't know about you, but I feel a little bit better after hearing what we're already doing, right? So, yay us! So it sounds like everybody is already doing something to intentionally care for the environment and particularly this watershed. And we're doing things at various levels. So for some of us, some of those levels may be easier than others, and hopefully for others of us, we can fill in those gaps, right? But when we come together as a community, we can see that we're actually already making quite a bit of an impact. Actually, that made me think of, I should have put it on a slide, that the Northwest Earth Institute does something called an Eco Challenge, and they're going to be doing something coming up in April, I think. So it'd be kind of fun for you all to sign up as a Bay Area Friends team or something to see what your collective impact is in the Eco Challenge. But we can talk about that later. But things like that that help us to recognize we're already doing good work, and if we take one more step, we can just add to what we're already doing. So hopefully that's encouraging and feels hopeful to you. That's one of those ways of building hope, is recognizing what we're already doing and that we've started. It's not like we have to start from zero. We're going towards zero in a way, but we're not starting from nothing that we've done, but we're starting from a place of already having momentum in that direction, and we can continue moving in that direction. So with that in mind, and maybe after you've heard everybody's things that they just said, you have some more ideas than what you had thinking by yourself. But why don't you get together with a group of people around you and share one or two things that you want to start trying to do on one of these levels. You don't have to share something from every level, but one or two things that you want to commit to trying to take a step on to intentionally care for the environment after today, today and following. Get together with a group around you and talk about that. But I'd like to hear just a couple of things from each group. What did there seem to be energy around in each of your groups? So anybody over here want to share a couple of highlights from what your group shared?
Well, we think we're doing a pretty good job.
You're doing a pretty good job already? No need to do anything else?
The city, the county, is
very advanced on your side. If you pay attention, your regular garbage hardly has anything in it.
Yeah.
And so that's not really trying very hard, but it's taking advantage of what's...
Yeah, so taking better advantage of the opportunities that are already available through the city recycling and all that. Great. Thoughts over here?
One thought that came up was you were saying that FWCC is encouraging meetings to have a garden. Mm-hmm. And we could grow our own mint for tea.
Oh, that would be good.
So that connection.
Yeah. Yeah, so growing some of the things that you use regularly. Unfortunately, coffee doesn't grow in this region, but start with the mint tea.
We can find out which herbs were used in the Bible medicinally and try to emphasize growing those rather than ornamentals.
Yeah, or things that were grown in this region medicinally and used by Native people.
I don't know if you get the idea. Uh-huh. Grow something to give away.
Yeah.
To share community.
Yeah, growing medicinal plants to give away. Great.
I know what the Native people grow to make rope, and I'm not going to make rope.
Yeah. But recovering some of that knowledge maybe that you would use could be useful. Back here, any highlights from your conversation?
Well, I didn't share this since I just had this idea. We're talking about buying in bulk, and I thought, oh yeah, I could buy in bulk at Safeway and put it in a jar and then use the bag for my kitty litter.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so buying things in bulk and then reusing the plastic bags that you have to use there.
Yeah.
Yeah, for things that you would have to otherwise buy a bag for. So, yeah, great. Over here? Anything from this group here in front?
What do you want to do with solar panels?
Yeah, well, I said that I was going to try and talk our condo association into using solar panels.
Your condo association for solar panels for your house?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, for all the units.
For all the condo units?
And I have been trying to get them to use drought-resistant plants instead. They said, well, it costs too much to change over. We have to hire somebody to do it.
Yeah, so continuing to advocate for drought-resistant plants for landscaping in your condo area. Yeah, good stuff. Okay, and I would encourage you all, since I don't live here, I can't do a whole lot about it, but I will leave it in your hands to continue meeting together about this, because I think that it probably would be encouraging to gather these different meetings together and have fun times for meetings or whatever, however many meetings want to participate, and gather and coordinate your efforts and share ideas of things that you're doing that other meetings might want to do, and do actions together that might work better if there are more people involved and that sort of thing. So I would encourage you at the level of the congregation to work together with each other and build those relationships to continue encouraging one another and keeping your hope alive in these endeavors that can feel a little bit scattered when we are trying to do it in our individual areas, but it can feel a lot more energizing when we come together to work on things. So hopefully that's something that you might consider and work on in the future. So that brings us to the end of our time together, and I'm going to invite us into a few minutes of silence just to reflect on the day and be present to the Spirit, and then I'll close us in vocal prayer. Present Spirit, we are so grateful for this time to be here in your presence and with these people. Thank you for the good work that you are already doing in us and through us. Thank you for this community of people to journey with. I pray that you would give us people to journey with closely, people to encourage us and to keep us motivated and keep us on track, people to discern with and brainstorm with and have fun with. And I pray that you would bring us wisdom and the courage to do the hard internal work that is before many of us. Give us a heart for being your people in this time and place. And continue to build this network of people into religious society of friends for the 21st century. I pray your spirit come powerfully on the friends in the Bay Area. Give them joy and energy in life. Amen. Well, thank you for being here today. I appreciate the chance to come and visit you all and to share my heart and to be energized by being among friends and hearing about all the good work that you're all engaged in. So thank you. I will stick around for a while and we can have further conversation if you're interested. And I'm available by email as well if people want to follow up later. But we can talk more about environmental concerns and how to start taking steps to move forward. We can talk about Sierra Cascades yearly meeting if that's something that you would like to learn more about while I'm here. We can, for those who would like to stay, let's gather and decide which of those topics people want to talk about, and we can decide what to do moving forward, whether we need two groups or one group to talk about one of those things or to talk about both of them. So thank you for being here. If you'd like to stay and converse more, feel free. And if you are ready to head out for the rest of your day, do that as well. Yeah.
Sure. I was asked to give an announcement.
Okay.
On Saturday, March 24th, there's going to be a demonstration in San Francisco organized by young people against gun violence. And our meeting house is going to be open for anybody who wants to participate in that from 11 in the morning till 5 at night. And we haven't made any formal plans of forming a group to meet there in March, but that might be happening. But if you come to San Francisco, you're welcome to come and do that. And the other thing is on March 14th, this coming Wednesday, the students are going to be staging 17-minute walkouts in most of their schools. So we're asking people, if you live close to a public school or work close to a public school, that you might think about just going and standing outside of the school at 10 o'clock. And for some reason, we want people to wear orange. I don't know why, but I guess if you're wearing orange, that shows that you're in solidarity with the students.
All right, thank you. Thanks for coming, and enjoy the rest of your day.